Blog Talk Radio.
I'm your host, Merle Exit. Well, let's see. Well, the temperature has gotten up here in New York City. I think it was like hitting like 70 degrees. Wow, what a change. But not for long. Yep, well, what you gonna do? And so I'm here in New York City in Queens. And, well, I had gone to Boston, Massachusetts, went to Boston, and pretty cool. Well, couldn't resist. JetBlue had this $39 one-way fare. Yes, and it was $39 to get back as well, with the tax and whatever. Well, I mean, who could resist, you know? So, had to get up there. And I didn't do a lot. I wanted to kind of relax and just tour around, you know. I hit a couple of restaurants there. And the thing I wanted to do was focus on a couple of Italian restaurants that weren't in the Italian section of Boston. It's called the North End. And, you know, kind of show you could just get just as good Italian food, and it could sometimes be even better, more authentic, not as touristy. And then I was, I was like so surprised. One of the places that I went to was called Erbalacci. Yeah, I just spelt it wrong on the thing. It's Erbalacci, not Erbulacci. Erbelucci. Okay. And so we're going to have Chef Charles Draghi, D-R-A-G-H-I. And could be Draghi. We'll find out when he comes on. And the owner, Joan Johnson, his wife, will be discussing the restaurant and also especially the tasting menu that I did with Chef Charles. And before I do that, of course, got to do a commercial. And the first one, of course, since I went by them.
Thank you for calling JetBlue. May I help you?
My cousin was telling me you guys have extra leg room.
Uh-huh. We have extra leg room as compared to a normal coach seat.
Okay. If I don't have an extra leg, can I use that room for something else?
No. That is not what the extra leg implies. We took out one whole row of seats, and that gave the rest of those rows a couple of extra inches of leg room. I understand what you mean. The words extra leg imply that, but it has nothing to do with having an extra leg.
I'm a pretty literal person.
Uh-huh. Well, that would be taking it very literally.
I guess a little too literally.
Okay. Is there anything else I can help you with?
I think that's it. You've been pretty helpful.
Thanks for calling JetBlue.
Dear traveler, stretch out. We now have the most legroom in coach. Visit us at JetBlue.com. Sincerely, JetBlue, based on average fleet-wide seat pitch of U.S. Airlines.
Oh, God. I know. I got Chef Charles and Joan on the line. Do you think, isn't that hysterical, that commercial?
Yes, it is.
Okay, well.
Thank God they didn't have extra headroom.
Yeah. Hey, that's true. Hey, I like that line. I'm going to use that from now on after the commercial is done.
There you go. Or trunk room.
Well, first, the thing I want to go into first, I got to tell you, Chef Charles. By the way, you're pronouncing it, is it Draghi?
Yeah, Draghi.
Draghi, okay.
That's plural of dragon in Italian.
Oh, okay. Is it?
Huh?
I have to tell you, I keep like, and I don't know why in particular, but I keep it every time when I'm thinking about the meal, the thing that goes into my mind is the scallop.
Yes.
I keep picturing that scallop, the way you cut it up, slice it, and of course, I have never seen a scallop served in its shell, not a big scallop anyway, like that. So
you see it in Europe a lot, but you don't see it over in this country very much. But that's almost the way that it's always served in Europe. And we get them in live, and we shuck them to order, take the top shell off, and then slice and put either a light marinade or sometimes we broil it very lightly, you know, sort of a rare, just warmed with a different vinaigrette. But they're really delicious that way, very oceany.
Okay, before we discuss the food, as I'm going to, you know, after I'm done with this, I'm going to probably raid my refrigerator. But I first want to begin with talking about the restaurant, Joan, as the owner. What prompted you to do this?
Well, we had been in the restaurant business for years, and we had a place in the North End called Marcuccio's, which we ran from 96 to 2000, and tried very hard at that point to open another one. But there was a little recession then, and we just couldn't raise money. And, we spent several years trying to do that and finally gave up. And then I just kept seeing this thing advertised in real estate. And, I finally called because I knew the realtor. And the rest is history. So.
Wow. So, now, and I'm curious, so when... When you had that restaurant, was it the same? Did you do the same type of menu?
Yes, we did.
You did.
Yep. And, wow. And back then it was very, very different for Boston. We were the only people doing indigenous Italian varietals with the wine list and the kind of food that we're doing, and of course Chuck. You know, that's all Chuck, the wine list and the food. It was a hit, but that was a partnership gone sour, so we got out of that. But, very similar.
So, in other words, it wasn't just the two of you on that one?
No, we had a partner.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we were running it for him with a small partnership on that, but this one is our baby.
Oh, that's good. It burped very well.
There you go.
So is this something like, Joan, I mean, as the owner, is this something like that you've always wanted to do? You always wanted to own a restaurant or you both? What prompted
you know,
Chuck, even restaurant?
I met in the restaurant business and it just we both worked our way through school in restaurants and just got into our blood and that's the end of that. So here we are.
Okay, and why Italian? What's is it Italian background?
Well, Chuck, yeah.
Yeah, my family's from Piemonte.
Which is, of course, I don't know where.
Northwest Italy, where Torino is, where they had the Olympics. So,
okay,
it's a really
Northwest.
Big food and wine region, really, you know, renowned for food and wine, and a lot of different culinary influences there, which go into the Piemontese cuisine. So when people talk about northern Italian food, my family's about as far north as you get without running into Switzerland and Germany.
Oh, okay. That's great. I mean, I don't know what I'm going to do about going to another Italian restaurant after going to yours. Honestly. I mean, wow. Okay, so let's get to, let's now get to the restaurant itself. Now, from what I understand, you know, like there's, you go online and, the, you know, there's no menu.
Yeah.
It's like, do you make it up, what, every day?
Yeah, we change the menu to some extent every day, particularly in the summer when the farmer's market is in full swing. It changes radically. I also wait to see what local fishermen bring me, change the menu according to that, and what I can get from the local farms, which is something a lot of chefs are doing now, but I've been doing it for, you know, over 20-something years. I've been in Boston, so it was a little tough sledding in the beginning because I really like to work off of local fresh. And the thing about the menu, on our website I put sort of signature dishes or the types of dishes that I do, but I don't like to put a menu because people will often make a reservation a month or 2 months in advance, and they see a dish, they get their heart set on it, and then when they come in, it's not there, and they get really disappointed.
Right.
So the rack of wild boar that's on there, that is my signature. That's available pretty much all year long except for in the really the deep heat of the summer for about 3 or 4 weeks. It's hard to get boar because they're actually wild animals, and they have to go out and find them, and they're from Texas. So when it gets real hot, they hide out. But pretty much that's on the menu all the time. And then there's other sort of dishes that are of a similar type, like in the desserts, the panna cotta. I usually have some version of panna cotta. The sauce may be a little bit different or the flavoring may be slightly different. But also it gives you and it says there's a little disclaimer saying we change the menu frequently, but it gives you a sense of what I'm cooking.
So now let us describe the restaurant for us, rather than my doing it.
Sure. Well, it's designed to look and feel very much like a northern Italian restaurant, in that it would be like a restaurant you would see in Milano or Torino, a very simple, clean look to it, a real warm, inviting kind of environment. I think it's a pretty romantic restaurant with the candles lit. The food is, although I always get written up as being very experimental or cutting edge or however you want to put that, avant-garde with the dishes, they're actually, almost all the dishes are rooted in very, very traditional regional Italian dishes that you just don't see that often in the United States. So a lot of the flavors, I always say that I cook in the vernacular of Italian cuisine, which means that I'll find ingredients at the farmer's market or something that's available, mostly organics, and I approach it in an Italian way, which is how would Italians handle these ingredients, which is usually as simple as possible, as clean a flavor, with little manipulation, and just letting the flavors come out.
Well, okay, I'll get to some other stuff. And by the way, and Joan, do you do any cooking at all, or are you leaving it?
I have done cooking, but you know, it's all things Chuck taught me. So.
Oh, okay.
So when we, you know, sometimes I'll cook at home, you know, because Chuck doesn't feel like it, because he's the one who's always cooking. But you know, we don't anymore because we're here 7 days a week. So,
Joan used to work as a private chef too for a few years.
So. Oh, okay. And by the way, I didn't get a chance, but I wanted to say that there's like a sort of open kitchen.
Yeah, it's a semi-open kitchen. When the place that we had in the North End that was really popular had a fully open kitchen, and a lot of our regular customers like to see me in the kitchen and be able to come up and talk to me about the dishes they've had. So we didn't want one that was fully open, but it's open enough that they can see me in there working. There's you know, a nice space where you can either look into the kitchen and watch what's going on, or if you don't want to look at that, it's not as intrusive on the dining room, let's say. So you can have a nice dinner and not pay any attention to the kitchen at all. So it's kind of designed that way.
So we
really like people to be able to get whatever they want out of the evening out of the place.
Yeah. Do you ever have people coming in over to the kitchen and, like, taking photos or something while you're cooking?
Oh, sure. Yeah. And the way the kitchen is set up, I expedite from the side of the line that is closest to the dining room so they can see me, and people can come in and ask me questions and talk to me without it interfering with the cooking of the line. So I'm standing on the dining room side, and so, you know, I have accessibility to both the food and the customers at any time. And then the big signature, too, with my cooking, which is why I have a strong following and a lot of people ask me questions about the food, is that I cook completely without butter. And I'm the only chef I know of anywhere who does that. And so the flavors of all the other ingredients really come out, and they're really pronounced, which throws people for a loop because my family's from Piemonte, which is a dairy area that has is known for butter in the cuisine, but I cook completely without it.
Well, it makes it. I understand in one of the videos that we did that you were saying about it that it because you do that it sort of eliminates having to add more salt.
Yeah, well, a little bit of butter is fine and it's delicious, but in traditional restaurant cooking, enormous amounts of butter are added to every dish. And what it does is it flattens all the flavors. So in order to get flavor back into a dish, you then have to add a lot of salt. And the flavor you wind up with, which people always call the restaurant taste, which they try to replicate at home, is basically a real salty, buttery base around which the other flavors are kind of fighting, trying to get through. And many lose the flavor of the vegetables, the meat, the herbs. It's very difficult for other flavors to get through that. The butter just sort of coats the palate, and it paints the palate, and it's hard for other flavors to get through. So, you know, almost pretty much every restaurant will add a big cook spoon of butter, which a cook spoon is 4 tablespoons. So it's a stick of butter goes into almost every dish. And then you have a handful of salt to get over that, and I just eliminate all that. No butter.
So in other words... You wouldn't say for people come to you if because they're on a diet. I mean, it's not like the rest of the food is dietetic.
Well, it's not.
It's just better.
You know, and it's not spa cuisine where you get a smoky on a plate, you know. But to be honest with you, I feel most foods already have enough richness inherent in them. You don't have to add to it. And so my foods have a rustic, rich, full flavor, like the gnocchi and dishes like that. But they just don't need extra butter.
So let's get into, do you remember everything you served me?
Yeah.
Good.
You want to go through all of it?
Oh, are you kidding? Of course. I want, because, now what happened, actually, I put up the photos and YouTube. It's on my blog, because I YouTubed, I think, 4 or 5 of the times when you came out. At least, and then I as many photos. But you know, I want to just go through it because I have to warn people that are listening to this. Please wear a bib while you listen to this. Okay, so the thing I wanted to start with first of all is the bread and the dip that was served. Go ahead with that.
Yeah, well, where my family is from is where Piemonte and Lombardia meet and Emilia joins and Liguria goes right underneath. So it's right where all those regions meet. And people from other parts of Italy call us the mangiafagioli, which means the bean eaters. So we have lots of different types of beans and bean purees. And that's basically almost like a hummus, if you will, of white beans pureed. It's spicy olive oil, some marjoram, and oregano, and a little bit of white pepper.
Wow. And even the bread
is made with organic flour, and it's a true Ligurian-style focaccia, which means that it's not this thin, crusty little bread. It has a little bit of density to it, and it's cooked with Ligurian olive oil, and just simple... And we put it in an oven, a high oven. But in the oven, and I do this with my meats too, I put wine corks and herb branches in the oven so it gets this roasty nut smokiness to it.
Wow. Now, who would come up with that? Is that something that people do? Do they do that in Italy?
Yeah, well,
I mean,
when my family...
As opposed to, I don't know what to do with this wine cork. Let's shove it in the oven and let's...
Yeah, as long as you're careful, it's not a plastic one. You're all set.
Yeah, okay.
But when I used to go to the village when I was a kid, they didn't have gas or electric or anything. All the stoves were wood-fired, and you started with dried-up grapevines as kindling, and then they'd put in this local wood that kind of smelled like wine cork a little bit. It was a type of oak. And that aroma, the firebox was separate from where you put the food, but that slight smokiness of that roasted wood would seep into the oven and you'd get those flavors. And so I found wine corks work really well with that. And so we put wine corks. That works, by the way, for any oven. If you're roasting a chicken or roasting turkey or pork loin, you put a couple of wine corks in the oven. They won't smoke. You don't have to set off any smoke detectors or worry about that. But it gives a beautiful roasted wood flavor to everything. So I put that in the same oven that I roast meats in and I do the bread in.
Not the smells, but does the fact of whatever wine it's from do anything?
Not really, because the wine doesn't soak into the cork too much. You just have to make sure that some corks look like they're cork and they're actually chips of cork pressed together with glue. So you want to make sure you get real cork. And then I take leftover branches from rosemary or thyme. We'll throw those in too.
Wow.
Have to be careful. If you use oregano, it might smell a little bit like a Van Halen concert in your kitchen. But other than that, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. Okay, so now that we got, now we just got through just not even the food part. Just
going through the bread.
Let me ask you about the olive oils. Do you always use the same olive oil?
I have a few different olive oils I use, but with the bread, I use a really beautiful one called Costo d'Oro, or Coast of Gold. It's from Spoleto, which is legendary for fantastic olive oil. It's in Umbria, and Spoleto, any of the producers from Spoleto are great. It's kind of in between the spiciness of Tuscan oil and the floral fruitiness of Ligurian olive oil. Kind of has the best quality oil. Has a beautiful, vibrant greenness to it. So.
Okay, do you use olive oils that they're all virgin, cold pressed? You know, the whole bit.
Yeah.
Or?
Some are filtered, some are unfiltered. I have some. Most of them are organic. I have some Ligurian olive oil that I really like with fish because it has a lighter herbal flavor, a little mintiness to it. I have some from Puglia that I'll use with. Which has a little smokiness to it, I use with roasted meats. Because I'm not using butter, I use other oils. Sometimes I'll use a walnut oil or a duck fat or, you know, a spiced chicken fat.
Oh, okay. So now let's get to the first of the...
The
tasting. And I want to ask you, or the thing I want to ask you, just so people get this, if someone comes in and says, you know, I don't know what I want, can I do a chef tasting?
Well, yeah,
can they do that?
Oh, yeah. We offer it every night except Saturdays. It just gets so busy because I create it on the spot and sometimes match it with wine pairings. It gets tricky on a Saturday night to create it. But on weeknights particularly, we get a lot of people who are real unophiles that like to come in and try interesting wines. You know, I do the wine list too, so I spend equal amounts of time. And I have this big Italian wine list, but all the wines are really very small production. Most of them are unknown outside of Italy, little village wines. So a lot of times people like to try that pairing.
So in other words, you find that more people do that because of the wine pairing rather than, I don't know what I want to eat, let's just do a tasting and no wine?
It's a mix. Sometimes people come in. Restaurants are always about building trust. So the first time somebody comes in, they may just have a plate of pasta and they try it and they really like it. And they say, well, next time I'll have a salad and pasta. And then as you build trust, you get to a point with your regular customers where they say, just feed us. We just want to come in. Everything we order here is great. We always have a great time. So you tell us, just feed us and give us stuff we've never heard of. or we've never tried before. And sometimes they want to try wines too. I get some wine writers and sometimes wine snobs who come in, and I'll do 7 courses with wines that they've never heard of, and it just boggles their minds that there's all these wines they've never heard of.
Wow. Okay, so now let's get to the first part with the, I guess, the
Mungili,
first thing.
The razors.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, one of those things that people like to try that they haven't tried before is razor clams, which you find the shells scattered all on the beaches around the Cape and in the shoreline, but a lot of New Englanders have gone their whole lives and not known that you can eat razor clams. They're, to me, the best bivalve local that you can find locally. And I actually have a lot of customers who ask me if I have them flown in from Venice because they're very popular there. So these are done in a Trieste style, which is in the city of Trieste. They steam razor clams with green peppercorns, fennel, a little bit of garlic and thyme, all made into like a pesto, and then a splash of white wine and some leeks, and steamed, and then I serve them over croutons. There they might use grilled rye bread, but really beautiful oceany flavors, a little bit of density to the razors, really nice.
So, and where did you say you get, you know, are you getting them from, are they coming in locally? Or
from Duxbury, yes.
So, I'm sorry?
From Duxbury.
Oh,
so,
okay, which is?
It's on the South Shore-ish, headed down that way, headed out toward the Cape.
Now, I had remembered at some point when I was, you know, it's a very Chinese dim sum thing to have when it's in season. That's what I got. And it's not always in season, right?
Yeah, the thing about razor clams is that, as a general rule, they get them around a full moon. And when there's a storm at sea, they're out so far that they need the tide to go out to the fullest to be able to dig them. So that's a full moon. And then the negative ions that come up from the earth during a storm bring them up, kind of like earthworms come up. So they're high enough in the sand they can dig them. So I'm never sure when all the stars are in alignment. And then they'll put them into tanks of seawater so that they drop whatever sand is inside them. So they just show up, the local fishermen show up. It's from some oyster aquaculture people locally who will go out and dig them. And they just show up and say, here's a basket of razor clams.
Of
course.
Yeah. What I was wondering about that, I know like people, I would hear people say like they're going, they dig for clams.
Yes.
Now they're just going on the beach and digging, but it's... what are those clams? The
quahogs, with the small little necks and cherry stones.
Those kind of things. And are these the type of thing? I mean, will they show up in the areas that people could just have access to and just say, let's dig for clams. Oh, let's, you know, get the razor clams while they're here.
Well, commercially, there's only a few licenses that are issued.
Okay.
So you don't see them in their restaurants or stores. But they're pretty far out. So as long as the tide goes out far enough, they're not in close to shore. That's why along the beaches they see the shells, but they rarely see the clams themselves.
Oh, okay. Okay, now we got to the clams. Now we got the clams. Now, to try to describe that,
Congealy?
Well, let's get through. All right, we'll do the congealy first before my favorite.
Well,
what'd you do with the scungile?
Scungile is it's a southern Italian name for whelks or conch. They're small whelks, and it's a dish that would sometimes be served with tomatoes. They're local whelks that come in with the lobstermen. The lobstermen usually crush them up to use them for bait for lobsters, so I have to convince them to sell them to me. And we just steam those. Take them from the shell, marinate them with a little bit of mustard and lemon and olive oil and lots of green herbs and shaved fennel, and serve it with a little bit of baby arugula, which is kind of a northern Italian preparation of a southern Italian ingredient, but I love the brightness of the lemon and the sharpness of the mustard with them.
They are good. I noticed you... One of the things that I noticed that you made very use of is fennel in your cooking.
Oh.
which is a wonderful. I'm curious, when you're using the fennel, are you getting like that whole bulb?
Oh yeah, and the greens, and we have the fennel seeds, and then we also Joan has a little garden she planted behind our place in Belmont, and she grows bronze fennel, which is the wild fennel you find in Sicily and Sardinia, and we'll save the seeds from the bronze fennel too, which has a really smoky, peppery flavor to it. So I'll use those as well.
I once made that mistake in the wild fennel, and I went, ooh, it's like it all over the yard. Took over the yard, man.
Oh, yeah, it does.
Yeah. You know, it's like you got to be careful when you grow that in arugula, boy.
Well, the neighbors started finding it in their yards, and then I told them, well, just sprinkle it on your salads, and they went from being angry to being thankful. So,
oh, that's good to hear. Okay, so now let's get to that wonderful seashell there with that sliced up guy.
Rose scallops, they're the deep sea scallops that are plentiful from George's Bank in towards shore. Really one of the best scallops in the world. And this time of year, what we normally call scallop is the adductor muscle that opens and closes the shell. So a lot of the rest of the scallop is thrown away, but we take them in live, take the shell off. There's the little bib that almost looks like a piece of calamari around the outside, and then the roe, which is usually orange or white inside, and just broil the whole thing. And then in the version that I did for you, I took some Meyer lemons, which we had just gotten in, beautiful Meyer lemons, and I sliced the scallop, if you will, and marinated with a little Meyer lemon, and I put a parsley pesto around the outside with some minced capers in it, and some of that Ligurian olive oil, the good unfiltered Ligurian olive oil.
That was so good.
It tastes like the ocean, doesn't it? It's so fresh. And
yeah, I mean, let me just clarify to people. Sometimes people, like, they'll sell scallops and they're not.
Yes.
What are they actually when it's...
Well, they used to, for bay scallops, they used to take basically a cookie cutter, and they would stamp fake scallops out of skate wing. And then a couple times a year, the price of scallops drop, and a lot of the larger restaurants or companies will buy an awful lot of scallops at a cheaper price and put them in a giant freezer and then sell them frozen throughout the year. And then, of course, a lot of the scallops that you see that are wet and have that sort of blue liquid around them, they're washed like a chlorine solution to preserve them. So if you buy scallops that are shucked, you want to always ask for dry sea scallops or dry pack. Those are ones that are shucked and they don't put any preservative liquid with them. But I just like getting the live scallops in. I shuck them to order. They clamp down on the knife, so it takes a little working, like the one that I sent to you.
Right.
But they have a completely different flavor. They don't have that soft, neutral...
I know what you mean. Yeah,
I mean,
rubbery.
They taste like the ocean. They almost taste like an oyster or something.
Yeah. Let me also ask you, in terms of the scallops. I mean, when the scallops look like they're like perfectly shaped,
yes,
that's not really good, right?
Well, it depends on how fresh they are. When they're freshly shucked, the muscle is so firm that they'll look perfect. But then they start to within a day or so, they start to relax, and they'll get a little bit oblong-looking. But they used to use shark and stamp from that, but shark has become so limited in the amount of catch that they're allowed to do that I don't think they stamp from shark anymore, but they used to stamp from skate wing. And then they would call them escallops of skate, and then they just shortened it to scallops. So... But, yeah, a lot of times when you went to a clam shack in the summertime and you ordered a basket of fried scallops, it wasn't really scallops.
Okay. That's all good. This is all good to know. okay. Now,
know your fish purveyor. Always know your fish purveyor.
Yeah. So let's now get to the next course.
Yes, the meat antipasti.
I think that was, yeah, okay. Hmm? Yes. Go ahead. Scroll.
So, okay. Now, in, well, one of my signatures here, we did the Speck, which is the smoked prosciutto. And we had the apples with it. I love this combination. Speck is from Alto Adige in Trentino in northern Italy. You also find it in Austria. And it's cured like prosciutto. It's not made from the leg. It's made from the belly. And it has a very subtle smokiness to it. They don't direct smoke. They just have, like, fires going in the room. So it's a soft smoke. With apples, that's a traditional combination. And then they use a lot of spices that seem kind of exotic up there because of the Venetian spice trade and that whole region. They like to use different spices. So I like to put a little sesame and mint with it. And I like the brightness and then that sort of roasty, almost smokiness of the toasted sesame with the speck. And then the apples, that nice acidity. And I use the local apples, which have really nice bright tones to it.
Is it common to be able to go into an Italian grocery and get speck?
Yeah, if you have a good, it's called the Sala Maria, and the Sala Maria is where they sell salami, and you know, basically an Italian delicatessen. If it's a decent one, they'll have sometimes speck from, and I'm using the German term there because they speak both German and Italian there. So speck would be what they would use in Alto Adige, but they have they'll have the Italian one, they'll have Austrian one, sometimes German, sometimes side by side.
Okay, I'll check out one of the places near me.
Mhm. And then we had, and then we did the meatballs too, right?
Yes.
So that was the meatballs were made with some lamb, and there was a little bit of wild boar in there, and some beef, and we put some lots of rosemary and sage. And crushed red pepper. And the sauce is roasted tomatoes that are pureed with a little bit of roasted tomatoes, a little bit of roasted onion, just pureed with olive oil, and a little crushed red pepper in that, too.
How did you come up with the idea of the combination of the meats?
The meats. Well, it's sort of a traditional wintertime combination that you would see with the heavier red meats. It's a little lamb, little beef, and then the boar is... When I was a kid, we went to Italy, boar was illegal to hunt. And then they really reproduced and took over a lot of Italy. And the favorite food of boar is wine grapes, right, when they're ripe enough to pick and make wine out of. So in Italy, they're kind of encouraging people to eat wild boar again. But you see it all throughout Italy in sausages and meatballs, salamis, things like that. So it's just a really nice, rich flavor, but it's different than the lamb. Like the lamb will have a little bit of sweetness. There's a nuttiness to the boar, and then the beef has a nice base flavor to it.
And you said you're getting the boar from Texas, you said?
Yeah. They're actually wild animals. They do a roundup, basically like a cowboy roundup, and bring them in, and I get the racks for the main courses, and then I get the legs that I use in sausages and meatballs, that sort of thing.
Hopefully they have a good time doing it and it's not boring.
Oh, yeah.
is there any, like, is there a part of Texas? Or is this a very common thing?
Eastern Texas, and they're all throughout. The boar, it's the same species you find in Europe. It's called Russian boar. And it was brought over by Europeans, mostly Germans, and they were turned loose for hunting, like, turn of last century. And they've just gone wild, and so they don't hunt them so much anymore. And they're pretty prolific through from Virginia southwest. There's a lot of them in Canada. We even had one crossing a highway near Boston not that long ago. So they're all over, probably being chased by all the coyotes we have now.
Mm. Okay. Now, what was the? I couldn't remember to write it down. There was the other dish that was with it.
Yeah, I think that was the brazaola.
Okay, that could be it, because I wasn't clear. Like, I videotaped it.
Yeah.
And I kept on going, what did he say? Now, what is it, brazaola?
Yeah, brazaola. It's a beef that's cured kind of like prosciutto and air-dried. It's made with beef tenderloin. And that's from the Elf Classic with some marinated olives and some shaved two-year-aged Parmesan.
So the top was the Parmesan? Oh, in other words, what I was kind of saying was, well, I guess, the fat, the thing that was white, the top. That
oh, yeah,
white.
Yeah, that's right. I forgot there was the lardo, too. So the lardo is, that's made from a Tamworth pig, which is an heirloom species of pig. And it's, you take the fat and you cure it with sea salt, right, with sea salt and rosemary for a few weeks. And then you slice it thin and put it on top of bruschetta with a little grilled bread.
Okay.
And a drizzle of Tuscan olive oil on that.
So is that what I had?
Yeah. So lardo is classic from Carrara area where they quarry all the marble, like Michelangelo's marble. And the workers there need a lot of energy, so they eat pork fat and they put it in these marble tubs with sea salt and rosemary, and then they put big marble slabs on top of it to press it. And then they'll just slice it and put it on toasted bread for their lunch. So it's a very classic combination. If you go to Azal Maria and they have prosciutto, you have the prosciutto that has a lot of meat and a little bit of fat, and then one that's about half and half. And then as you get more and more fat to where it's all fat, the price goes way up. Because for Italians, the more fat, the more valuable it is. Whereas over here, most people go in and they ask the fat to be trimmed off the prosciutto. For Italians, that would be horrifying. It's like, no, that's the good part.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah, yeah. So when you get to lardo, like if you have prosciutto that has almost no fat and you have lardo, the lardo will probably be 10 times as much in price as the prosciutto with very little fat.
Because lardo, like that.
Yeah, the lardo is the most important part.
Okay. Now I want to get to those olives. Yeah, I understand that you marinate your own olives there.
Yeah, those were green olives that were in a brine for, almost 2 years. I usually brine them for at least a year, and then I'll soften the brine with a little water. But basically, I take green olives, we slice them, we put them in a bucket with all different herbs and garlic, sliced lemons, and sea salt, and we alternate layers, and then I pour a whole bunch of white wine on top of it and seal it and just let it go for a year, curing.
They look like, I thought they were whole olives, no?
Yeah, they're whole olives, yeah.
Oh, okay.
We cut like a little notch in the skin.
Oh, okay. When you say you slice it, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, is that why, when I see notches in the olives, that's
exactly,
what that's about?
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, so because it's so thick that the brine doesn't get through the skin, so you just have to give it a little slice. But the commercial olives that you buy are pretty much all treated with lye to break down the proteins and to break down the bitter acids. And I don't use any lye. I use a couple of changes of cold water, and then I brine them straight out. So they're really meaty and very, very intense.
When you say the commercial ones, you're talking about like when you get them in the jars or the cans versus, let's say, if I go to, one of these stores and they have a whole olive, all types of olives that you could choose from. Are those also in lye, you think?
All of them are treated with lye. Yeah. And, my family never did that when they could get the olive.
And you're not lying? And you're not lying,
not lying
about,
no.
Are you? No. Wow.
You just cure them straight out with wine, sea salt, lemon, and lots of herbs.
So, in other words, if you really wanted to, if you wanted to bother, you could, you're buying, fresh olives someplace, which I don't even know where to get.
Yeah. Yeah, and you can get them online. In November they usually have them, and people can buy them for home. They can get a case of them or, however much. You can have them, air freighted to you. But there's a local Italian produce purveyor who gets them for me.
Oh, okay. Well, that's quite interesting.
Yeah.
I might attempt to do something like that. Yeah. Actually, I wouldn't even know where to get lye from.
Well, see, you don't need it, But that's
why
we have density, because the commercial ones can be a little soft and pulpy because of that lye. But the great thing about it is once you put the brine together, you can use whatever marinade you like, and you just put it in a container. You don't even have to think about it for a year. Just leave them in a corner
wow.
of the basement and let them go.
Oh, man. Ah, okay. Let's go on to the next item.
Okay.
What was next after that?
I think we did a soup, right?
Yes. Next was the soup. Go ahead.
That's a, it's called a vellutata or a passata, which is what we used to call it. It was a vegetable soup. You had the beet one, right?
Yes.
And it was with roasted root vegetables, you know, very wintry, sort of local organic carrots and parsnips and celery root and beets. And that was in an herb broth with a little bit of sun-dried tomato. And all that was pureed to a real smooth soup. And then we sautéed some black trumpet mushrooms and put that inside with a little bit of purple basil and marjoram.
That was so good. I'm telling you. I'm sitting here thinking, how will I ever get this food again? How will I?
Well,
you have to come back here, Merle.
I'm telling you, where will I ever find... I have to tell you, I mean, I almost feel badly about, and when it comes to dealing with the writing, it's like, I honestly go, what happens when you've gotten the best? I mean, really, what happens when you've gotten the best and now you have to, you know, now I have to, let's say I go out and I'm going to an Italian restaurant, you know, I mean,
well, that's,
you know what I mean? It's just hard.
That's the hook. Yeah, now you have to come back.
Yeah. Okay, so, and let me ask you about the, using celery root, did you say? Did you
yes.
use celery root?
Yes.
When you use the celery, tell me how you use celery root, because I've been buying celery root, and I really don't know what to do with it. Basically, I'm taking a microplane and, you know, mm-hmm. shaving it into
oh, yeah.
a salad, but
into
it's got to be some
that's
other thing.
Great. I like to put it into soups where I cube it and slow roast it till it gets a nice brown caramelization, and then put a little stock or a little broth over it, and then you can puree it and make a really smooth soup. Also, it's great to just roast. I like it with parsnips, celery root, parsnips. Maybe cut a little julienne with some olive oil, lemon, salt, pepper, and just put it in the oven and let it roast until it's nice and soft. It's delicious.
Yes. Oh, that was that's really good. I've been playing with a lot of stuff. And as a matter of fact, tomorrow I have somebody. Actually, it's olive oils that are from Greece,
mm-hmm.
and I had never seen so many different types of olive oils. I mean, with all kinds of flavors in them, and you know, whatever and. What I had found in using these, I haven't gotten to use them all, but I found using these because of the flavorings, when I'm cooking, I don't feel like I need to put any salt in it.
Yeah. No, you don't, because the minerality is so high that you already have really mineral salts in the olive oil, you know, because it's a lot of minerals, so you don't need it. They already enhance flavor just on their own.
Yeah.
I remember years ago reading Alain Ducasse, you know, who had still has 2-3 Michelin star restaurants, and he would fly back and forth between them with a helicopter. And they asked him, is there a quintessential plate that you can never achieve, but it's like the plate you're always aiming for? And he said, yes, an immaculate piece of fish, incredibly fresh right from the ocean, cooked perfectly on a plate with a drizzle of good olive oil. And that's it, on a plate, just like that. And he said, I can never achieve it because the fish can never be fresh enough. It can never be cooked perfectly enough. He said, but the olive oil, I know, will always be right.
yeah, that's good. Oh, and the other thing I wanted to ask you while you, I'm sure you would know. When it comes to some balsamic vinegar, does it make a difference of how old it is? How long,
oh, yeah.
In terms of being aged?
Oh, yeah. Well, first of all, almost all balsamic vinegar that's sold as balsamic vinegar is not balsamic vinegar. So most of it is red wine vinegar. that has caramel added to it. Some of it may be aged in barrels for a year or two, but it's not really balsamico. True balsamic vinegar is the only vinegar that is not made from wine. It's made from fresh grape juice. So they don't make wine first with yeast and then let the bacteria sort of spoil it into vinegar. It's made straight into vinegar, so it has a completely unique flavor. And then you need to concentrate that through evaporation. And since they put it in barrels, the evaporation is very slow. So anywhere from 12 to 20 years is the minimum for a decent balsamico. When you go 25 years and above, then you start to really develop these flavors. And they go through different types of barrels. They go from oak to apple to cherry wood, down to these little juniper wood barrels, and they pick up the flavor of those different woods. And they'll use the same barrels for generations and generations so that you really pick up the sort of distillate flavors of all those batches that have been made for hundreds of years. So it's really special stuff. But the thing is, when you get real concentrated balsamico that's anywhere from 80 to 100 years old, usually is the oldest, you just put a drop on something, and it blooms out, and all those flavors expand. You know, the best way to try it is really good fresh strawberries sliced with a couple of drops of balsamico on it, and it'll change your life. It is really special.
Well, that'll be interesting. The thing I had noticed with balsamic vinegar is, like, when I taste it, it's a vinegary taste.
Yes.
Does that mean it's not, it's, should it not have a vinegary taste?
Well,
usually
it's sweet and smoky, almost molasses-like, with layers and layers of herbal notes and fruit, and the acidity should be moderate. You know, it should just be an accent to it. Kind of like the acidity you get from really nice, sharp apples. But, you know, you get a tartness, but you get lots of levels of flavor. That's true balsamico. The one that I use, standard, is a 25-year aged one where you can actually taste the chestnut wood and you can taste the juniper wood that the balsamico's been in. But the other ones are red wine vinegar, and they're usually too high in acid, and they just add caramel to them.
Oh, that's interesting. I should have had, you know, because I had told you I'm allergic to balsamic vinegar.
Yes.
I probably should have tasted it. It probably wouldn't have tasted the same as what I had. The reason I'm asking this is because one of the things I had gotten was this balsamic vinegar. And
yes.
I went, oh, I don't know how I'm going to even try this. And I just said, all right, let me just taste. And tasted completely different from the ones I've had. I said, wait a minute. It's really sweet.
The sweetness just comes from years and years and years in the barrel of the water evaporating out and the juice concentrating. And that's the inherent sweetness and developing those flavors through oxidation and everything else. But the true balsamic is very expensive, but you don't need much. You need a drop on something, you know, a couple drops. You know, if you roast some pork loin, you just put 2-3 drops on it and a little drizzle of olive oil. You don't need a sauce. Spectacular.
So how would I know, like, if I'm buying it, what am I looking on the label to see?
Well, the really good ones have three different color seals. There's a red, there's a gold, and a silver seal. And as it gets older, the oldest ones, they say, could be 80 to 100 years old. They're not graded by how many years they've been aging. They're graded by the viscosity, the intensity, the levels of flavor. So when they feel like it's good enough to get a gold seal, it gets a gold seal. But you can go, there's online, you can buy them, and there's a really wonderful one called Rubio, which is moderately priced, that is a 25-year-aged balsamico that's spectacular. I think that's maybe $30 for a bottle, 370 milliliter.
Okay. So in other words, but if I'm just going to the store, am I looking for something, it would have a seal on it?
Yeah, or you can, you know, if you go to an Italian purveyor, you know, a Salamaria or a good Italian market and just ask them.
Versus Stop and Shop.
Yeah, well, they may not have it at Stop and Shop, but.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's all right. So when it comes to something like that, if you go to, you know, a store, I guess I suppose like a, I don't know if all the vinegars, the balsamic vinegars are necessary. Are they all from Italy if it's a balsamic vinegar?
Well, yeah, they may say Modena, which is where Balsamico is from. But
Okay.
But at the same time, it may not really, it may be just a wine vinegar with caramel. So you might have better luck online.
Okay. Let's continue. I knew I was going to ask you all kinds of questions. That's okay. So let's continue. What was the next thing?
New York.
Oh, God.
I was getting that reaction with the gnocchi.
Oh, wow.
Special Piemonte. So there's two things, a gnocchi and a panna cotta. If I can't do those right, then I'm in trouble because I've been rolling gnocchi since the time I was a little kid. The gnocchi are made with roasted potato. That's the way I do it in the winter rather than the boiled potato. And we roast them with a little bit of prosciutto fat, rosemary.
Are you roasting the whole potato or are you taking the skin off first?
Yeah, roasting a whole potato.
Okay.
And then once it's roasted, then we run it through a ricer and make a gnocchi with, and you see a lot of recipes where it's just potato and flour, and then sometimes potato, flour, and some egg. My family always put a little milk in there, and the milk really lightens it up, and it makes it so the gnocchi are really a very soft dumpling texture. My aunt always said that a gnocco is the singular, by the way, that a gnocco should be like a thumb against the roof of your mouth just for a second and then melt away. And that's the way we design them. And then the ragu with that is, I made a ragu.
You know, I just put my thumb against the roof of my mouth. Yeah, go ahead.
Was it potato-y?
No, not quite, man. No, not at all.
And with that, we had a ragu of, there was some wild boar, a little bit of rabbit. That was braised in red vermouth and red wine with some lots of rosemary and sage and juniper crushed in there. And then at the end, once it's simmered for hours, then we put in a little bit of minced sun-dried tomato, because winter time still, so sun-dried tomato rather than the fresh. And there's a little carrot, celery, onion in there. And then two-year-age Parmesan.
So let me ask you a question about, in terms of the rabbit, when you're prepping in the kitchen, do you say, shove a rabbit in the oven, we need to...
Sometimes.
What do you do?
Bad rabbit.
Yeah. No, what do you do to prep in terms of, I mean, do you serve rabbit on the menu?
Yeah, we do. We serve rabbit, roasted loin and leg on the menu. I usually will take the loin off the bone and put a little bit of porcini and a little seared rabbit liver along with the loin, and then we take the belly part of the rabbit and wrap it and also put a little liver in the legs. And then I'll take the forelegs and we trim up that meat and grind it up to make into a ragu. So, but the rabbit adds a really nice soft gelatin. So when you make ragu with boar or beef, it needs something to give it a little extra gelatin. So the rabbit is perfect that way. When you simmer it for hours, the reason you cook a meat ragu for so long is not that necessarily the meat needs to be cooked that long itself, but it makes the gelatin come out of the meat. And so it gives a really nice soft texture to the sauce. So, you know, in a bolognese style, basically a bolognese style sauce. And that's why you simmer it for 3 hours or so to get all the gelatin to come out. So rabbit has a lot of gelatin and it gives a really nice texture.
Mm. Okay, now let's go on to the next.
Nazzello, the fish?
Yes.
So Nazzello is, I usually use English terms for my dishes for the ingredients as much as I can. Nazzello is a type of hake, but there's four hake species that are local. And three of them are good fish, but they use them for fish sticks. And then there's one that's really special that's called long hake. And in Italian, it's called nazello. A really beautiful fish. So with that, I like to, because it's very flaky, I like to wrap it in greens and season it with a little, little bit of crushed fennel seed. And then I roast it in the greens, and then there's a sauce made with organic carrots that are pureed with some lemon and capers and a little bit of tarragon and some fresh thyme. And that pureed sauce is around it. So it's really beautiful flavors.
Yep, certainly is. Let me ask you about the capers. Do you use, I guess, I understand it's like two types of capers. Like there's these, you know, little tiny ones that, you know, out of a jar. And then there's, I guess,
yeah,
what do they call them?
I use the salt-packed capers that are from Pantelleria, which is a little island off of Sicily. It's famous for capers. So they're the large, larger capers, and they're packed in sea salt, usually the sea salt from Trapani in Sicily, which has the, you know, the windmills that pump the sea salt over big flats, you know, the seawater, and then it dries into the sea salt. Really beautiful sea salt. So I get the salt-packed capers, and the sea salt's so good, I use that for seasoning. It gives a slight caper flavor to things. But I use those capers. Capers are the unopened flower buds, and you can almost taste the flower in those because they're just so fresh and beautiful.
So you're getting them from there as opposed to caper cod. Caper,
yeah.
Cod. Okay. Caper cod. Okay.
I bet they could grow capers out there.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, I could say. Now,
yes.
Now we get to dessert, right?
Oh, we get the meat course still, right?
Oh, the meat course. Oh, of course. Right, that's when I had the rack of boar. Oh.
Yes, chingale. Chingale is wild boar, and it's that's really the, you know, the big meat of Italy, and it's one that I use a lot. So that's my signature dish, which is the roasted rack with a thin coating of pureed black olive with a little bit of juniper and lavender in it, just enough to hold the moisture in, not an awful lot of the black olive. And then the sauce is, since I don't use any butter, I've had to come up with different sauces that are kind of my own technique. So this is what I call a mosto, which I take wild Concord grapes, and they're actually wild grapes. I have farmers go out in the woods and get them. And I crush them, and I let the natural yeast ferment them like I'm making wine with some lavender and rosemary branches. And then I run the grapes through a food mill, and the fermented grape pulp and juice is the sauce, along with the pan drippings of the meat. And that's a variation on my uncles in Piemonte were all hunters. And there's not a lot of sauces that are used in traditional Italian cooking, so they would roast a rabbit or pheasant or boar. And they would also make wine, so they would take the skins from the wine caps as the wine's fermenting and throw it on the meat with olive oil, and that would be their sauce. So it's a variation of that. You know, you get a really intense floral aroma of the grapes, that fruitiness. It almost tricks you into thinking it's going to be a sweet sauce, but it's been fermented so that it's really dry. And that's something that I was always trying to come up with a sauce style that used fruit, but the traditional way is you cook fruit with a lot of sugar and you basically make a jam. And I didn't want anything that sweet. So if you just take fresh fruit and you grind it up into a sauce, it oxidizes and you lose the flavor of the fruit. So this is a kind of way of preserving that intense aroma and not having it be a sweet sauce.
Oh, okay. Now... All right. I have to pause for a commercial, and then
sure.
We'll get to dessert.
Okay. Sounds good.
What would you do to earn brownie points? How about treating someone to what may be the best brownies they've ever tasted? Fairy Tale Brownies. They may seem like one of the richest bars of fudge, with varieties that include
caramel, chocolate chip, espresso nib, raspberry swirl, mint chocolate, all made with Calbo dark Belgian chocolate. But yes, they are brownies, and that's no fairy tale.
And yes, you can get these wonderful brownies at www.brownies.com. Yes. Okay, back to you. Now you can describe your dessert.
That's a good way to lead into desserts.
By the way, they are the best brownies I've ever tasted anywhere.
Wow.
And the problem is you can only, unless you're out in Phoenix, you can only get them online.
Oh, no.
Yeah, well, but that's
them online.
Okay.
They sound great.
Oh, yeah, they're really the worst. Oh, no, then when there's certain times of the year that they sell them, they sell them as like truffles, so they enrobe them in the Belgian chocolate.
Oh, wow.
that's a killer.
Oh.
Okay, so let's get
to it. Chocoholic, so you're really speaking my language.
What kind of chocolate do you use when you make chocolate desserts? What do you use?
A cocoa berry or Valrhona sometimes, mostly Calbo.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. Yeah, that's so you know.
Oh, yeah. Joan
Okay.
A lot of the chocolate from me as I'm making things.
Yes, I do.
We share that. We're both chocoholics. We fight each other over the white and dark chocolate.
Really?
Yeah.
Do you ever come into New York for the chocolate show?
No, I haven't, but I'm dying to. It's like Vin Italy. It's one of those things I have to get to because it's just too.
Let me know. I'll get you in.
All right.
Me know. I'll get you in. It's always in November. Just so you know.
Okay.
It's outrageous.
Us, though. We'll be passed out on the floor in some kind of hypoglycemic coma. They'll have to revive us.
Well, the problem, and I have to call it a problem, what happened is Fairy Tale Brownies used to be a big sponsor. And
yeah.
They would come there in terms of the media.
Yeah.
So when they were open to the media, they would sponsor by having real breakfast food.
Yeah.
So you can eat some breakfast before that you start, you know, with all that chocolate and sugar. But they stopped doing that, and it's like, oh, my God, you know. but anyway, so let's get to it. Chocolate doesn't have to, I mean, you don't have to be a chocoholic to have great desserts. And in your case, you know, you definitely don't. So let's describe the two desserts that you did put in front of me.
We had the panna cotta, right?
Yes.
That's a Piemontese classic. So panna cotta means literally cooked cream. And you start with really good, rich cream that's so thick that you don't have to add anything to it. So you heat it up with just a little bit of gelatin. And so it's like a custard but no egg in it. And instead of sugar, I use an herb blossom honey, locally made herb blossom honey, where they put the beehives in a field of thyme and rosemary on that one. And so they're drawing nectar from those herbs. And then the sauce is a traditional tart cherry sauce with amarena cherries from Italy and then also some dried tart cherries just cooked in a little bit of red wine and honey to make the sauce.
Mm.
Very custardy.
Yeah, I've had the amarena cherries in the gelato.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, that's something else. Yeah.
Yeah, they're so good.
Yeah. Mm.
Yeah, they have big pits and a small amount of flesh, but they're really intense flavor.
Yeah. Okay, that was one.
Okay. Yeah. And then the second one, I forget what the second dessert was. I said, was that the poached pear?
No, I think there was something. Wasn't it with chocolate?
Oh, then it would have been
with hazelnut.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's why I thought I'd send you the gianduia. The gianduia is a chocolate truffle combination. Sometimes over here they call it bacio. It's dark chocolate with a little bit of Frangelico and then some Italian hazelnuts. And there was a sauce underneath it made with local apples that are cooked in a little bit of mace and honey and pureed, and then a little dice of apples, which is one of my favorite combinations. You don't see it over here that much. Tart fruit with chocolate works really well. So you see cherries, you see oranges, but apples with chocolate are fantastic. And really beautiful counterpoint to the flavor of the hazelnuts, which are kind of rich. But the Gianduja is from Torino in Piemonte. Torino was the first city in Europe to make chocolate. And they have a lot of wild hazelnut trees everywhere. So that chocolate-hazelnut combination is a classic of Piemonte.
What I love is the hazelnut paste.
Yeah.
When it's made into that paste, it's just.
Mhm.
Yeah.
So good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wait now. What? So let's just now that we've gotten to that.
Yeah.
Just give us some ideas of some. What are the other signature dishes that we haven't mentioned that you do offer?
Well, the razor clams and the boar are two of the signatures, but other mm-hmm. dishes that people come in. A lot of my dishes are in a repertoire, so when the season comes around, people start asking about specific dishes. But the rabbit main course is something that's really popular, and then some of the fish that I have, tautog, which is a local fish, really, really delicious. It has a nice, meaty sort of bass flavor to it. That one, I usually cook that with a little shellfish sauce because tautog eat almost exclusively shellfish, and I always find that whatever the fish is eating usually finds its way into the flesh, so to do a little shellfish sauce with it, a little bit spicy with some tomato, is really, really nice. That's always really popular. And then when I can get them, it's been difficult this past year, but a baby octopus is always a huge hit here. And I do that Sicilian style with a relish of tomato and orange with fennel and saffron and a little bit of minced red onion in it, too. That's really tasty. I just take the baby octopus and just char them in a pan, and then take that orange tomato relish and throw it right into the pan to just heat it up. It's fantastic.
Do you go around experimenting with the sauces and things to do?
Oh yeah.
I mean, wow! How did you come up with the combinations of these things, to make a sauce?
There's three or four different sauce techniques that I've come up with that are kind of uniquely mine, but everything that I do is based on traditional combinations and traditional flavors that you'd find in Italy. So it's experimenting, but kind of within, as I said before, that vernacular of, as an Italian, how would I approach these ingredients? And usually it's to approach them very simply. Classic French and classic Italian food is sort of the opposite ends of the spectrum, where classic French food, it's all about the chef and the technique and the wizardry the chef can do. Whereas in Italian cooking, the chef tries to step out of the way and let the ingredients do the talking. So half my time is spent as a hunter-gatherer, if you will. I go out and find the best ingredients and bring them in and, try to put them in a way that's interesting and different, but at the same time not overly manipulated.
Well, Joan, do you have any favorites on the menu that you say, Chuck, cook this for me, please?
Yeah, it depends on the season. So I always look forward to the different seasons. We have fiddleheads coming up and asparagus, and Chuck will do a lemon zabaione with those. And it's just I just can't wait, until the farmer's market kicks in, because it's, I'm looking forward to tomato season. And then Chuck does braised sunflowers when the sunflowers come in. And those are...
Was that the farmer's... I think while I was on doing a pedicab, I think I passed... It was like the strip that looked like a farmer's market. Is that what you're talking about, or is there another one?
No, they open up seasonally in Copley Square. There's one at Government Center. You may have gone by Haymarket, which really isn't a farmer's market.
That could have been. It was, yeah, okay.
Yeah, it used to be. But that's basically all the old stuff that comes from the warehouses in Chelsea that they sell, and it's not very good.
Oh, okay. So, in other words, it's in. You would go to, like, Copley Square and see...
Yes, yep. And they set up, you know, they have canopies and tents, and they set up there, and, you know, they bring stuff in every day.
Oh, okay. So I guess it's like then here they do this in Union Square in Manhattan that they do that. Okay. Just I wanted kind of to get an idea of people that are traveling to Boston.
Yeah.
it
is like Union Square. And I cooked down in New York for a while, and you get to know the people setting up the tables. You get to know the farmers. You get to know their families. And a lot of times they'll ask you, is there something you want me to grow for you? I have this little plot of land if you want me to do special herbs or different ingredients. And I do a lot of herb cooking. So they're constantly growing things for me, like lovage or anise hyssop or bronze fennel or lemon balm, things that you don't normally see in the markets, but they'll raise specialty crops.
Yeah, and we have all that stuff in our garden as well. So,
wait, what's your address? I'll be...
We'll set up the Smoky Joe. We'll do a little grilling on the patio, and the herb garden's right next to the patio. Just throw the herbs right in.
Oh, goodness gracious. Let me ask you one more thing. First, let me get into it in regards to the menu for people to kind of get. So if they want to do, I understand you do a 5-course tasting and a 7-course tasting. Am I correct?
Yeah, with or without wine matched.
Yeah. So let's say someone says, let's do the 5-course tasting without wine. Is there always the same price, or it depends on the day or what?
Yeah, I mean, it kind of fluctuates a little bit, but the 5-course is generally around $75, and then another $20, $25 for the wine pairing, depending on the wines. And the 7-course is anywhere from $80 to $90, and then another maybe $30 for the wine pairing.
And that's like, that's per person, am I getting?
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay. Just so people, when people want to go out and really, honestly, I mean, that's not bad these days. I mean, if you go out and you want to, it has to be someone that really appreciates food.
Yeah.
To say, I'm not spending that kind of money, but if you appreciate food, you're going to eat and go, the experience.
Yeah.
And you're not, and it's not a kind of thing of like, you're there for 10 minutes either. I mean, you know, you're there for quite a while, and you're really dining, and you're really, like, savoring, and, not planning to go to see a show after.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
No, that's the event.
Yeah.
Having the event.
No, that's for sure.
I also gauge it by the people dining. If they're really into it and it seems like they want to do a little more, sometimes I'll add another course or two. And then we have the bar in the Inoteca, which is sort of our cafe. And we offer, we do a 3-course sort of mini tasting, 3 or 5-course mini tasting there. And the 3-course is $35, and then you can add another $15 for wine pairing. So it comes out to $50 for food and wine for a few courses. So, you know, you can do it on a, you know, in a more, price-sensitive way, or, you know, and then I always, being Italian, I'm always inclined to throw an extra course in and do a little bit extra, so.
So when you're doing this, like, the 3-course, is it basically appetizer, entree, dessert?
Yeah, and then sometimes I'll put a little extra course in there, too. It depends. Yeah. Sometimes people want to do a 3-course tasting, and then they are going to a show, or they, you know, they only have an hour and a half to eat. But if they're spending a little time, I'll probably put in a little extra pasta course or something else. And, you know, we really like to gauge it so that people get the kind of evening that they're looking for, where they want to spin and have a quick plate of pasta and move on, or if they want to really make a full night of it. You know, that's part of what we do here. You can have a very formalized dinner with some very expensive wines, or you could just drop in for a quick bite, and you feel just as comfortable in the space no matter what you want to do. You know, you could use it as a casual place or as a more elaborate place.
The other thing I wanted to kind of ask, I was up in the where the bar is, and I saw all these kinds of bitters.
Yes. Yeah, we have a lot of Amari that we do, all these different bitters, and we do a flight of Amari, so you can try three different ones. We'll do like a little taste of a little bite of food to go with each that sort of complements the flavors in them. You know, whether it's a tart cherry or an orange or a herbal flavor or a spice flavor. I try to match little bites of food to go with it. And we have lots of Amari, which are, you know, a great way to end a meal.
I'm very curious about that. So if somebody says, so in other words, that's something more that people would come in not to have a meal, but like after an event or after dinner or after kind of thing. You mean?
Yeah, that would be perfect.
So
yeah,
when you're saying you pair it with some bites, a bites of like what type of things would you be preparing for somebody?
Well, for instance, there's one Amaro that has, it's made with orange peel and some spice, and it's actually not that bitter, and it has a nice herbal quality to it. So I have this orange cured salmon, it's cured with orange and rosemary. It's like a lox, if you will, but it's done Italian
right.
style, a little crushed red pepper. So we might put that on like a little piece of endive for someone to try. There's a real smoky, deep one that has a lot of chocolatiness to it. So I've used some bitter chocolate sauce over a piece of roasted boar or roasted beef. So it's whatever reflects the flavors in the Amaro. And then we have dessert ones, too. We'll do Sicilian eggplant with chocolate and sweetened ricotta. So it reflects the flavors of the wine. It'll be like, you know, a couple of bites worth.
Okay. So... and now for something like this, like what is the cost of something that what this type of thing? Were you pairing bitters and?
Well, if they want to do the Amari are different prices, but they're all about $9 or $10 to try, and then we have a flight which is $19 with little bites of food to go with it. So you get three different ones and three little bites of food, which I think is a nice, you know, nice light little snack. But it's amazing how different they are in flavor. Some are very intense and earthy, and some are light and floral, and some have high alcohol, and some have low alcohol.
Okay. So now we got you on. You're located 69 Church Street.
Yes.
Which is, how do I describe that, between?
Bay Village, which is right in the center of Boston. It's the oldest neighborhood in Boston.
Okay, and...
Right.
You're also the website is www.erbaluce. Where does the name come from, by the way?
Erbaluce is a Piemontese dialect that means dawn light or morning light. It's also the name of a white wine grape from near where my family's from in Piemonte.
Okay. That's great. Well, I think I've talked your brain out already. Pick your brain.
All right.
What now?
We'll always talk food. Yeah, we'll always talk food. So.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you coming on the air. I don't know what the heck I'm going to eat right after this. So it'll actually satisfy my taste buds at all. But it was good having you on.
Great. Well, thank you so much.
Actually, I'm going to...
Thanks for having
actually,
us, Carol.
I'm sorry?
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, I'm going to... what do you call it? I don't want, as opposed to trying to listen to this all and write it down, is there a possibility you can send me the descriptions so when I write the article, it's just like in front of me?
Yeah. I'll try to type that up tonight and send it off to you.
Okay, I appreciate it very much. What I had planned to do in terms of the article is getting changed. I was going to do something on the two restaurants that I went to, but this is going to be an entire article in the Giornale Italo Americano just on your restaurant. I just want to let you know.
Thank you. Appreciate
it. Thank you, Merrill. That's great.
Yeah. Okay. So, again, thank you very much. Thank you. I'll go get a napkin and take the drool off my mouth. Okay. And have a great evening, and I'll be
you
in touch.
Too. Yeah, anytime you're back in Boston, please come by.
I will.
Love for you.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You. Bye-bye.
Oh, my God.
Hello?
Di, did you hear? Did you get to hear this whole...
Yes, I heard the conversation.
And I'm
in Boston also. This is Stanley Hurwitz.
Oh, hi. How are you? it's funny because I don't know that we didn't pick a time exactly,
No, we did not, and that's why I'm calling. I was really apologizing.
That's fine.
The two co-chairs of this gallery of understanding, neither one was available this evening, and since I do publicity for the school, I figured that I might as well fill in for somebody. So I don't know, is there a certain time I should call back or what?
No, it's fine. You're fine now. It's okay.
So I feel I didn't want to let you down because I knew that, you know, there's nothing worse than having 15 minutes of empty time on a show.
Oh, no. What happens is I can actually like end the show early or throw in music and whatever.
So do you have
that's really great.
Do you have the news release that I sent you?
Yes, I can't get to it though, because of on the computer. Introduce yourself, and you know this week, and tell everybody what it's all about.
Well, so this is Stanley Hurwitz. I do public relations for the South Area Solomon Schechter Day School. It's in Norwood, Massachusetts. The school's about 22 years old, and a few years ago they decided to honor an 86-year-old local Holocaust survivor named Israel Arbeiter. They dedicated a room in the building. It's called the Israel Arbeiter Gallery of Interfaith Understanding. And Mr. Arbeiter has basically spent his entire life since surviving the Holocaust traveling around the world and speaking about his experiences and talking about understanding between different kinds of people, and a lot of it he's been traveling almost annually to Germany talking to school children there, and then he travels around the United States talking to kids here, not just Jewish kids but anybody who makes a good audience. He was born in Poland, in pre-war peaceful Poland in the early 1920s, and when the Nazis took over, he lost most of his family members, and through some miracle, he survived some of the camps, and he was on some labor camps and death marches, and survived it all, and came to America in around 1950. And after he immigrated, he rebuilt his life, and he had his daughters and family, and he just in the last couple of years, his first great grandson was born. So anyway, this Gallery of Understanding has a display about his life. There are large panels starting in 1923 in Poland, and shows nice black and white pictures of the little shtetl in Poland with his. There were five brothers, and only two of them survived, and the parents died also. But it traces his life from before the war, then all through his whole itinerary through the various concentration camps, and then. And then after the war and coming to America, and it talks about his fighting against American Nazis and then his testimony before Congress. Just in the last few years, Mr. Arbeiter has testified before Congressman Barney Frank's committee regarding insurance payments from the European insurance companies that claim to not have records of the victims of the Holocaust who had paid premiums on life insurance policies. And I guess there's billions of dollars that's at stake here to go to those families. And he's testified to help make that case. Should I keep going?
Yes, of course.
So anyway, last year I read a story in the newspaper that talked about this family from Needham, Massachusetts, the Mandels, who had inherited from Mr. Mandel's uncle had died, and he left them his belongings from New York. And among his belongings were things that he had taken after a battle in World. He was a Jewish GI in World War II. Mr. Mandel's uncle had taken a copy of Mein Kampf from the dead German soldier in that battle, and the copy of Mein Kampf was signed by the mayor of Lübeck, I believe, and it wished that young soldier good luck in the battles and good luck in his new marriage. But anyway, that didn't bring too much luck. But Mr. Mandel had the book, and he wanted it to be displayed in his house when he inherited it from his uncle who passed away last year, 2 years ago. Mr. Mandel proudly displayed the book, and Mrs. Mandel said, "Get that out of here." So it was a constant battle between the two of them. And I read the article in the paper, and I said, "Wait a minute, this is an idea." And I called, I contacted the Mandels, and I suggested to them that maybe they'd like to put that book on display as an educational tool at the Arbeiter Gallery of Understanding at the South Area Solomon Schechter School in Norwood, Mass., which is not too far from where they live. And I said, anytime you want to look at the book or visit, you want to visit it or take it to show relatives, you can do that. But meanwhile, it'll be on display with a descriptive card and an exhibit, and it'll be the first artifact in our little museum. So that was, in fact, the first artifact. That was about a year ago. And then shortly after that, we had a story in the paper about the first item, first artifact in the Arbeiter Gallery. And a woman read the story, and she came in one day, and she said, "These are from my great-grandmother. There were two passports. One was from Czechoslovakia, and one was a passport to enter Palestine." And it was from her great-grandmother who survived the Holocaust. And anyway, she donated the two passports, and those became the second and third items on display in our little museum. So several weeks later, this takes us to last fall, a substitute teacher saw the little display, and she said, "I have something to donate." And she brought in this unbelievable Luftwaffe ceremonial sword. That's from the German Air Force. And it was in perfect condition. It was worn, I guess, in very fancy ceremonial officers' get-togethers that the Nazis held. And the sword, it turns out it had an interesting story behind it. I believe, great-uncle was a rabbi, a chaplain in the war, and one of his jobs was to go through the warehouses that held the looted items from various synagogues across Europe. And among the looted items, he found this Luftwaffe sword that was really in unbelievably perfect condition. It had the swastika and the handle and the scabbard made out of leather. And anyway, her chaplain relative died and left it to her, and she donated it to our display. So all of a sudden, we have this very fancy sword from the German Air Force. The story got into the Boston Globe, and about 3 months ago, a retired major from Florida was reading the story about our little growing museum, and he contacted me, and he said, "I have a Norden, N-O-R-D-E-N, bomb site." Anybody who's listening to this can look it up. And a Norden bomb site is a very unusual item to have in your possession. It was invented in 1938. It was a very, very early computer, but it didn't just have a lot of electrical stuff. It also had the old-fashioned gear shifts and a clutch and ball bearings, and it was like the marriage of the old and the new. And they put these Norden bomb sites into every B-17, and it made it so that you could very accurately bomb a target from 20,000 feet in the sky. And this major from Florida had gotten it from a friend of his who died at the age of 90 several years earlier. He had been a pilot of B-17s that used to bomb industrial targets and military targets in Nazi Germany. So he said, just pay for the shipping and we'll send it to your little museum. And I said, it's a deal. Anyway, a couple of weeks ago, the Norden bomb site arrived, and I had done some research, and it's interesting to find out that this bomb site, there's one on display at the Smithsonian, and there's one on display at the Air Force Museum, and several other very high caliber. Can I use the word caliber as a pun in there? Very high caliber displays around the country, and here now we have one of these that we're going to be putting on display at the Arbeiter Gallery. And, you know, I look at these things as making all of these items as making it so that World War II and the Holocaust and the whole that whole era comes to life. So, yeah, you can read the story about Mr. Arbeiter, but for little kids in the school is grades K to 8. So at different levels, the teachers can use these objects as starting points, to springboards to talk about, you know, did something like this. It killed people on the ground, but maybe it shortened the war and saved lives in the long run. Maybe it saved Jewish lives who were in the concentration camps. Maybe it shortened the war by being accurate to be able to bomb a factory for the Allies to have this particular item in their B-17 Flying Fortress. You know,
right.
So over the last few months, we've also gotten some donations of interesting books. Some more recent and some actually that were printed during the war that the authors were talking about what was going on in Europe and what about somebody donated some very interesting books about what was happening to the Jewish population of Europe. In the books written in 1942, there were people who had suspicions in the authors of books, but well, we all know what happened. They were right.
Yeah.
That's where we stand. The reason I had sent out the press release is that I was hoping to stir some interest around the country and that maybe people who hear your show might know of people who have interesting artifacts. They don't have to have monetary value, and maybe they have some historic value, that an educational value that we can put on display at the gallery, and of course, the donor gets credit, and then if we have an interesting side story or background for it, we put the descriptive card next to it, and that makes it into we're going to make a real museum. That's really my vision, is to make a real museum in the Arbeiter Gallery. It's interesting, Mr. Arbeiter, when the presentation was made by the Mandels to Mr. Arbeiter, we had about 50 of the Jewish kids from the school, and we had 50 Catholic kids from a nearby parochial school. And the Mandels presented the book to the school, and Mr. Arbeiter accepted it on behalf of the school. And one of the kids said, "Hey, Mr. Arbeiter, do you have numbers on your arm?" And he took off his sport jacket that he always wears, so he always looks so prim and proper. And he took off his jacket, he rolled up his crisp white shirt, and there were his numbers tattooed on his arm. And it was unbelievable how. Amazed, the kids sat so quietly, looking at his arm. But he said, "I want the school to accept this book because of what it represents, and it's a good learning tool to see it to actually have a tangible item there to show how the power of words, and you can change the world for good or for evil." And Mr. Arbeiter said, I want you to promise that you'll display this book upside down as a sign of disrespect. We're displaying the book, but I want it to be upside down. And the book is actually in the display case upside down.
Oh, I never heard that being done.
Yeah, no, it was. I think it was his idea, because I don't remember seeing it anywhere either. But
anyway,
the bottom line is that people have been coming forth with things that they... Yeah, either don't have room for, or they think it's going to get lost, and it's kind of sad because you see things at flea markets and you see them online on eBay, or you see people talking about them. You hear people talking, and it's kind of sad that they're going to get, when people sell their house, they don't have room, they toss it out, or they don't know what to do with something, they don't understand the value of it, and I don't mean monetary value. I mean the value of it, to put something on display for kids to see, makes the 1950s 30s, 40s, et cetera, come to life, you know?
Right.
It makes everything, it makes it more tangible.
Well, let me ask you, okay, if people want to donate, is there a website?
Well, you know what? There's a school website, but that's and if they go to the school website, which is www, and then it's the five letters that stand for South Area Solomon Schechter Day School, S-A-S-S-E-S.
Okay, so it's called...
It's six letters.
Okay, so the place is called the South Area...
Solomon Schechter Day School.
Solomon, spell it S...
S-C-H-E-C-H-T-E-R, Schechter Day School. So it's six letters. It's SASSDS.org.
Okay, so it's SSDS.org.
South Area. S-A-S-S.
A-S-S-D-S.org.
Yeah, there's six letters. Six letters, S-A-S-S-D-S.
Okay.
South Area Solomon Schechter Day School.org. That's the website for the school, and then you can find contact information there. There's no, I don't know, there might be a button there to press for the Arbeiter Gallery, but there's a good phone number for that.
People donate. They can
if they want to talk about it. They can call the development office, and that number is 781-769-9400, 781-769-9400, and they can talk to whichever staff person answers the phone there in the development office can talk about the gallery and we're looking for these items to be donated. We're not really looking to buy them,
right?
People can talk to their lawyer or their accountant, but you get a tax deduction for a donation to a nonprofit organization anyway. I think this Norden bomb site that I was talking about that was used in the planes in the B-17s. I looked it up. It has a value of $1,200, but the guy who donated it just wanted us to pay for the shipping, which was about $40.
Right.
So, and then if somebody just wants to talk to me about it, they can certainly call me. Should I give my phone number?
Yes, go ahead.
All right. Well, I'm 508-269-0570. 508-269-0570.
Okay.
My name is Stanley Hurwitz, H-U-R-W-I-T-Z. And anyway, I think the vision here is to make this into a real, almost like a little museum for kids, you know, that brings that era, and I'll use the word I say to brings it to life. As sad as it was, it might make it so kids are inspired to study more about history and to learn more about the Holocaust, and maybe to study more about World War II, and the Arbeiter Gallery of Understanding. That's the whole idea is Mr. Arbeiter said that when it was first established 3 or 4 years ago, he said he wanted the whole mission to be to teach peace. So we have some of these things from World War II that we're using to teach peace. So I think that's kind of ironic, and it's a nice way to honor his wishes. We've had some very interesting guests visit the gallery. They've come to the school for various events. We've had, Cardinal O'Malley, first time that anybody can remember that a sitting archbishop in Boston visited a Jewish day school in the Boston area, and Cardinal O'Malley visited in November of 2009. And then last year, about a year ago, we had Peter Yarrow. Does anybody remember Peter Yarrow?
Oh, I know who he is.
From Peter, Paul,
As
and Mary.
Peter, Paul, and Mary, yeah,
he was
sure.
He was at the school at a fundraiser, and he was deeply moved when he took a little tour of the Arbeiter Gallery, and he was moved by the display there. That's before we had most of our objects in the artifacts collection. He just read the story of Mr. Arbeiter's life. And then not too long ago, back in November of 2010, Alan Dershowitz visited. He was at the school as a keynote speaker for an event, and he spent a lot of time looking at the exhibit. So it's the gallery is helping to put the school on the map, or is the school putting the gallery on the map? It works both ways, right?
Yeah.
So that's the story of the gallery, the Arbeiter Gallery of Understanding, and the artifact collection that we're putting together. If anybody wants to donate, I was also going to say that if anybody wanted to make a donation, they could certainly make a monetary donation to the gallery. But the but the artifacts are really right now it's a focus because we had a very interesting visit from a well-known jeweler in the Boston area who came in to look around, and he said he's going to try to find some nice display cases so we can have a impressive display of our artifacts as they come pouring in, you know? That would be nice.
When people are donating, is there some acknowledgement?
Yes. Well, you mean next to the exhibit?
Yeah.
Yes, we've got a nice little, just like in a real museum, I have a card that explains the background. And we give a historical background of that item, and then each item has a connection to the donor, like a family member who was involved with it in World War II, like the chaplain who was a great grandfather of the woman who donated it, and then there was the uncle of the people who donated the Mein Kampf book.
Right.
So there's a connection, and I try to make it so that the exhibit card tells not only about the artifact and its historical, putting it in historical perspective and how it played a role in World War II, but also talk about the donor and their connection to that item. So it's sort of like wrapping Antiques Roadshow and History Detectives and eBay and the museum and the Metropolitan Museum all into one little place, and right now there's only half a dozen objects on display, but maybe some people will come forth with some more interesting items to donate.
Well, I owe someone a phone call. After I finish the show, what's happened is I happened to have gone to this Greek restaurant. And while I was there, there was a woman there, I guess she was celebrating a birthday. I got into a chat with her, and she turns out to be a Holocaust survivor.
Really?
But from Greece.
Mm-hmm.
And she wanted me to get in touch with her because she wanted to know, I had put something in the newspaper about it, about when I was writing about the restaurant. And so she wanted me to call her, let her know when it's in the newspaper. And I just thought, you know, gotten to different things I had to do. But now that you said this, I said, oh, let me call her also to ask her if she has any artifacts, too.
Ah, that would be nice. Yeah. Anything. I even have, my mother-in-law has a little blue box. Remember the little JNF boxes? The little Jewish National Fund collection boxes?
Oh, yeah.
Well,
oh, God.
Well, people look at those, you say, big deal. But I did some research, and they go back to before the founding of Israel, when it was Palestine. It goes back to the 1920s, I think, maybe 1930, whatever. But there were different boxes. Each decade had one or more different styles, and you can tell what decade it came from by what languages are on it. Like the early ones have Yiddish. So you've got the early JNF blue boxes have Yiddish and English, and then I think it goes Yiddish, Hebrew, and English, and maybe the American ones are mainly English and maybe some Hebrew on it. But what's interesting is that even those little blue boxes, you don't want to put a new one into the display case necessarily, but if somebody had something as simple as that from going back to the 1920s with Yiddish on it, those little blue boxes were being used to raise money for the a purchase of land and for the reclaiming of the land of Israel, getting ready for, at some point, nobody knew when it would happen, but getting ready for 1948 when the modern state was founded. So that little blue box would be like something as simple as that somebody's going to toss in the trash, and that's why they're rare. I saw that some of those little boxes can be worth a couple $100. One of the reasons they're rare is people look at them and say, just a little blue box, and throws it away, and there's no more left. That little box could be a good teacher for a little kid who says, what's that for? Why is there a slot on top? You say, people used to put nickels and dimes into it, and that helped to buy trees and lots of and to drain the swamps and get the soil ready for people to move to Israel. So see how something simple like that can make a whole story.
Sure, sure. Yeah, I'm kidding.
So, I mean, you don't have to have a bomb site from a B-17 flying fortress to be an interesting artifact, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So that's my vision. That's what I want to turn that in. That's what I do PR for the school on a, you know, I'm a public relations consultant, but this is above and beyond that. I want to make something a little more tangible to make that gallery into something that has some more meat besides Mr. Arbeiter's incredible life. I want to have items in there that people can look at and talk about and kids can learn from and adults can say, hey, my father used to talk about that, or I remember this, or I learned about that. So that it's good for all ages, and all those items are unique. They're unique because of how they fit into history, and they're also unique because of the way how people got them, how they came across them, whether it was from an uncle who shot a Nazi soldier or somebody who got it from a B-17 pilot, you know?
Yeah.
There you go.
Okay.
So, Merle,
well,
I didn't want to let you down. I didn't want – I knew – I just
okay.
found out – I only found out at 7 o'clock that my second string hitter wasn't available, so here I am.
That's fine. That's absolutely
okay.
Great. I'm glad that I can give you the time to
so
share.
So now what
that.
Happens? What happens to the interview?
What do you mean?
What happens to on Blog Talk Radio? How does that work?
Oh, well, if you want, you can pull off like just this part or just link it on. Is there a website that you have?
Yeah, well, I can link it to the school website, I suppose.
Yeah, you can pull off this part as far as what I'll be doing, because I have to go back to the description and put it in there and put the taglines in there.
Okay, so tell me how do I just go to blogtalkradio.com and then look for this or what? Look for your name or what?
Oh, sure. Oh yeah,
okay.
It should be on there. We're live now, and this is archived.
Okay, all right. I wasn't sure how.
That's how it works. So we're live now, and then anybody can go to. I keep this archived, so anybody can go and listen to this interview and listen to the whole show or just this part, whatever they choose. And as I said, what I'll do is I'll make sure that in the description, you know, that you have the taglines.
On the description, do you put the contact information also?
If you want,
I would like you
that.
To, so that I would like you that so that if people do have something, they could get in touch with us, and we could tell them, you know, coordinate that.
That's not a problem at all. I could do that right in the description.
Now, if I want to email you with some other ideas for people to talk to,
you mean?
I think I sent you an email a little while ago, so tell you that I was going to call you. So it's just Merle at.
Do it at M E X I T.
Wait, M E X I T.
Yeah, M E X like as in Merle Exit.
Oh,
so
okay.
It's M Exit.
Yep.
At earthlink.net.
Oh, okay. All right. Very good.
I changed my name to Exit so I can see my name up in lights.
This way out. M-E-X-I-T at earthlink.net. All right,
yeah.
Good. I have ideas for other ideas for you, okay?
Sure.
All right, thank you, Merle. Well,
yeah, you're quite welcome. And have a great evening.
Thank you. You too. Nice talking to you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay. Well, I got a few minutes. I would like to, I don't know. Okay. I just want to throw in, maybe I'll wait till tomorrow. I have another show tomorrow where I want to comment on that I saw the show Hair. And well, I can just kind of basically tell you now. I show the show here. So it's on Broadway across America. And so Hair is one of the shows that's on tour. And the Boston rendition, I was no less than seeing it on Broadway. It was wonderful. The difference, I guess, is the price is cheaper. You may not have, you know, the name people doing it. There's no, you know, stars or whatever. Sometimes with Broadway Across America, there are, you know, there is a star, there's a name and whatever. But the show is amazing. I think they took, to me, it felt like they took more liberties of being able to talk with and mingle with the audience. They were constantly coming out to the audience, and there were some points where they actually talking to the audience with the show. The singing was fab. Oh, well, I love the songs. You know, nothing to say, what can I say about that? And so if you happen, go online, go to Broadway Across America, and just Google it, you know. You can Google it. and you can check to see what shows are on tour and at what cities. I had already done one in Fort Lauderdale. I saw Les Mis, which was, again, fabulous. I don't know, awesome. I can't find words other than the words I'm saying. It was just great. The talent is wonderful. Maybe they try more because they're not on Broadway. Who knows? But highly recommend. Unfortunately, at the Colonial Theater in Boston, it already closed. When they go on tour, there's only a certain amount of time, and that closed. So look for them though. Go online and look for where the show, and hopefully it'll be in a city where you live. Well, I'm gonna end now. I'm all talked out and hungry, and definitely need to have something to eat. I'm not even hungry, just because of talking about all that wonderful food. So tomorrow is more about Boston, one of which is going to be chatting about where I stayed up in Beacon Hill. And also I will have on, we're talking about olive oils too. So there's lots to be discussed tomorrow. So everybody, take care. Have a great day, evening, or whenever you're listening to this. And yes.